Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony. Thank you for tuning in to episode 215. And I'm very, very happy to have, once again, good friend of the show, one of my favorite local artists, and I've been told some people's favorite guest that they've heard on this show. It's the uncouth, the uncanny Mr. Mike Ruth himself. Mike, thank you for coming back to the show. How's it going, buddy?
Hey, it's going great, man. It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you. That's great feedback to hear. I'm glad people enjoy my old windbaggy rants. That's good. At least it gives me some purpose. So
you're looking for purpose these days. You're one of those what's the word? There's some people who are just natural orators, right? Like they can speak and they. The interest in what it is that you're saying is palpable. So definitely a good guest to have. It doesn't take much preparation. Whenever I know I'm going to be talking to you, I'm like, this is going to go smooth, and we won't have any trouble finding things to talk about, which is good.
Oh, that's fun, man. That's cool.
Every time I think of you, I always envision somebody at a drawing table. I see like that hand that's on the cover of the Animal Man. The cover of that issue where there's just that hand drawing things into existence. That's what I think of when I think of Mike Ruth with a pencil in his hand. And when we started this conversation, lo and behold, you got the pencil in your hand and a big commission happening. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's an all day kind of thing, man. It's honestly, it's a life. It's a whole life. It's more than a job sometimes. And you know, it's yeah, when it's good, it's good. You know, that's all I can say. When it's good, it is truly rewarding kind of work. You know, sometimes it's tough. You know, sometimes you get bad news, or sometimes you get your hopes up for stuff. But you know, it's a funny business.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, you gotta work at it all the time, whether it's good or bad, whether it's paid or not. There's comics to be made, and there's work to be done. So you got to keep on rolling with it for sure.
And you've been able to keep busy under the circumstances where I know normally you would have just gotten through a good season of shows and cons traveling across the country. But have you been able to stay busy, all things considered?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if nothing had been canceled, I would have already had, I think, about 12 shows under my belt, and I would have been looking forward to the Winnipeg show in October or November. I think it was late October, and I believe there was a couple of shows around that. There was also Saskatoon, which would have just come and go. So I had the memory come up for that the other day for Saskatoon Comic Expo, which my first time going last year to that particular expo, and it was just an incredible show. It was easily as busy and as intense for me as a guy who draws for a living. It was easily as busy as Fan Expo, and I was kind of stunned by that. Maybe not quite as busy as Fan Expo, but certainly on par or better than Toronto Comic Con in terms of how busy I was and just how intense the weekend was. That had a lot to do with the fact that I was there with Justin from Big Country Comics. And anyway, yeah, we had a lot of shows planned, he and I and Stefan and my wife. Actually, we had a whole tour planned, and yeah, normally we'd be sitting in kind of a cushier spot after Fan Expo. Fan Expo is a show that would, you know, that essentially pays for my livelihood for a couple of months. That's why so much work goes into it. And when I do take pre-orders, they very often take up the entire month of August to get sorted, so I can show up at the show with a bunch of work done and a bunch of pieces and in partial completion, and then take on new work when I get there on the Thursday night. It's been changed, but I have been lucky. Yeah, I've been busy. Doing all kinds of covers and all kinds of fun stuff. There's a few projects that haven't been announced yet, which are coming, and just, you know, cover work mainly, and yeah, I'm working on getting the final touches of Dodge issue 2 sorted out so we can launch that Kickstarter. And the Kickstarter certainly kept me busy for the most of June and July. I was fulfilling all the Kickstarter drawing rewards and doing all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's been an intense summer. I have no idea where September has gone.
Yeah.
Already October is next week, and I'm just like, wow. But yeah, definitely, I've been trying to keep busy. That's what you have to do, I think, and certainly, you know, with the potential second wave that's underway or whatever, and the potential shutdowns that can continue, you just gotta have some other options, I think. So,
Yeah.
You know, so when I'm not drawing, I'm looking for those other options. You know, I'm feeling, I'm sort of blindly feeling the edge of the riverbank, feeling for stones, feeling for anything I can get a grip on, you know, to try to make something latch. And you know, sometimes you get some tasty fish dangling in front of you, and sometimes they slip away, and that's just the way she goes, right?
But, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm positive. I'm trying to stay positive. It's been hard to stay positive. I was just looking at it. It looks like the last time we did one of these was in April, so I actually have no idea where all that time went. Honest to God, man, it's been a little crazy. So, yeah, man, there's been a lot of good stuff to be happy about, and a lot of stuff that's just been kind of like, wow.
Yeah.
Heavy, real heavy.
It's, I mean, it goes without saying that 2020's been a ridiculously weird year. It's been super slow and then super fast. Like, it's just the year of complete extremes. And I know all of these things are cliches right now, you know, unprecedented, all, but it really has been. And it'll definitely be a year when, you know, 20 years down the line, 30 years down the line, we'll look back at this year specifically and like, damn, we lived through that. It's kind of like when I watch those decade shows on the news channel. CNN sometimes goes through like a decade, and you really like, all of this was happening all at the same time. And we've had one of those years right now where you're right, it's hard to stay positive. But then when you step away from all of the noise a little bit and you just calm yourself down, remember, okay, I remind myself there's a lot of blessings that you've got to be grateful for, and just to be able to have a person that you enjoy living with at this time be there with you to go through it and to talk to and bounce ideas off of in and of itself is a real blessing. So to be able to have conversations with people you like talking to is important right now, which is good.
It is, you know, it's funny, just on that point, someone tweeted the other day, I saw it go around, someone asked a question, what is the best habit you've developed since the COVID outbreak, and what is the worst? And there's a lot of interesting answers, and I was trying to think about what my answer would be, and the funny thing was, what I came around to was the fact that the answer to both questions was the same. And that is, I've gotten really good at avoiding people. You know, for whatever reason, I've gotten really good at avoiding people. And unfortunately, I've gotten very, very damn good at avoiding people. And, you know, partially out of necessity, mostly out of necessity. Where I live is kind of busy. It's a busy street corner. It's noisy. It's a lot sometimes, man. And, so that was my answer to the question, was both things.
I think that's
to both things. It was it's been a real time of you know, you reach out, you try to connect, and I'm really more, I'm getting to a place where I'm almost more comfortable doing stuff like this than I am gathering in person. Like, I'm constantly invited to people's, you know, houses for dinner and you know, the backyards for like little gatherings, and I turn them all down because I'm just not there, man. Whether we are there yet is debatable, and that's the problem. But I think that for me, I'm not there yet, and so it's been hard to make plans, you know. Like, we saw a friend of ours we haven't seen since March, and the fellow that I'm doing this big Wolverine piece for right now, like, we're gonna see him potentially for the last time for a while because he's moving to the Maritimes next week or in a couple weeks. And you know, it's tough. Like, we've had all this separation, and now it's like some people, you know, we can't even connect with now that even if things opened up. So yeah, man, it's been tough and it's been weird, but it's been part of how we've been able to, you know, survive and how we've been able to piece it all together, I think.
Yeah.
It helps the focus when you just kind of, you know, almost become slightly hermited. But if you're working and you're using that time, like, my days start when I wake up and they end when I go to sleep. But there's no, you know, I don't have kids, so I don't have that extra challenge. But I'm awake and I'm a work. If I'm awake, I'm working. Basically, is kind of the lifestyle right now, and that's cool. I'm all right with it. I enjoy what I'm doing, and for the most part, I do.
That's the key. That's the key. Is to, you are keeping busy with something that you enjoy doing, whether it was when you were finished work before, because you didn't, you know, weren't drawing all day long before, but that was your way of unwinding and taking a breath. And now you get to focus on that and drown out the noise. Because I tell you, you go watch the news, before you know it, you've been waiting for updates for a couple of hours, and you just feel, I don't know, even when I go online sometimes, I'm scrolling, seeing people's comments with all the stuff that's happening in the world, and it starts to, like, this heaviness on you.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like, I gotta go and pick up a book and just read something and get lost in, you know, the Marvel Universe. It sounds silly, but...
Yeah.
It's just too much sometimes. It's overload, and you don't know what you can say.
Avoiding the social media as much as you can, and then avoiding those scroll traps is key, I think, man. And it's hard because I find myself caught there all the time. I'll say, okay, let's go to bed, and 15 minutes later, I realize I'm still in trance looking at some article I've gone down the wormhole on, and down the rabbit hole on. And I've been posting a lot less. I feel like that's part of it too. That's part of that kind of hermiting thing that's happening right now. I don't post as much as I used to. I try not to complain or engage as much as I used to on Facebook or anything like that now, because I just haven't got the patience for it.
How does that affect you now? Because that's interesting, because I've been thinking about that too, where I listen to a lot of various podcasts, getting all these different things of information, things that I don't get to see when I go on Facebook or the news. And so I want to have dialogue and discussion with people, but I always tell myself, Eric, don't comment, don't ask a question, don't complain, don't do it, because it's not going to work. It's just going to aggravate me personally. How do you find it's been for you avoiding engaging as much?
What I find is a good method for me is I will actually respond, but then I'll never post it. I'll actually write the response and get that shit off my chest, and then I will sit and reflect a moment, and I'll go, you know what? This is going to open up a bee's nest of shit that I don't have time for today, because I don't have time for it. And then next thing you know, and I don't even have Facebook on my phone. I have all my notifications off, all this stuff. I don't care, because I just go on once in a while to check on my friends and see what's going on, see if there's any cool Kickstarters happening, just try to get a bit of that kind of news versus the other kind of news, which is the wrong kind of news, and it's the potentially false kind of news. And there's my wife just left Facebook, and I've never seen her so happy and so just generally more focused on her work and more just joyous as a person. And I've noticed that palpably in the last 2 weeks or so, or week and a half that she's been off. And I'm really, really almost there myself. If I didn't have so many cool things that I engage with on Facebook, like this podcast for one, which gets shared here, and also Martin's thing, the Sketchomania, which has been such a blast and really kind of a highlight of my every month, or it's usually the thing I'm looking forward to the most all month, because it's a chance to hang out with some people, man.
Yeah.
In a way that doesn't mean I have to put on pants or whatever the criteria might normally be for a social gathering.
Right.
But
that's great.
I'm very much become a homebody, and I'm kind of good with it. But Facebook has been. That I think this COVID thing has put that into a sharper focus for me. How very important it is for me to maybe limit myself. I wish there was I think everyone's on it because it's free and it's always been there, and our lives have been lived on it. And I think it might be time for me to go in terms of a profile. I can still maybe access some other things, but I like Instagram. I know Instagram's owned by Facebook. I know that's all part of the discussion too. And That's probably true. And Facebook and Instagram has changed to the point where it's barely useful as a marketing tool as what it used to be. But it's literally the only thing I'm really using. Twitter, I'm barely on. I have a few people I engage with personally on Twitter. But beyond that, I don't engage in any of the politics or shit on Twitter. I just kind of had this point where I just had this threshold. I crossed it, and I just can't stump any more of it, man. I don't even have cable TV, right? So I don't have the news. Like my mom, for instance, listens to CNN all the time. Like she listens to it nonstop. And I know people who have the news on 24/7. And depending on which channel you have playing, you can really start to What I notice, it brings a grimness into people when they're just constantly on the sharp all the time with what's up to date. I've felt bad. I've had the news, Canadian news, slip by me and have someone go, oh, did you hear about that fire? Did you hear about that thing or that whatever? And suddenly be like, what? When did this happen? And I've really been disconnected. It's been a deliberate move. So I feel like I'm there already at the point where I want to just kind of clip off Facebook and maybe clip off some of the others and just really get focused on my stuff. Yeah. I only ever had a smartphone because I was a superintendent 8 years ago, whatever it was, 10 years ago now. And I needed it for that job. And right. I abhorred the idea of having one. I hated the idea of having a smartphone on me or having Facebook in my hands all day. I just wanted to draw and get my chores done, but I had to have this damn thing in my pocket. And now it's been like 10 years later, and it's become an unbelievably great tool in a lot of regards, you know, for comic cons or for sketching or for reference photos or for whatever it ends up being, you know, your mail, your email. But Facebook and all these things that have come with it, it's like a heavy chain in my pocket that I don't need to have in my pocket. It's like when I was a young man, a dashing young man, and I used to wear 3 and 4 chains attached to my wallet, you know, and attached to my coat or attached to my head or whatever the chain was sticking out of. It was one of those things where, you just start to realize it's a lot of extra weight and baggage you're carrying around. And so a cell phone that's got Facebook on it becomes something like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's become something that I'm aware of. And so there's times when my phone will die because it's an old phone. So it'll die for a couple of hours. And I'll just be actually, I'll 3-4 hours later will go by and I'll go, oh, I haven't looked at my phone in 4 hours. And like this strange, you know, like the One Ring begins to call Gollum, you know what I mean? It begins to summon me and I start to crawl towards the damn phone. And it's a real thing, man.
It is.
And it's something I'm aware of. And I don't know. I think like the COVID has brought that into focus. Sorry, I went on a big long.
No. that's okay. It's. I was thinking about that these past couple weeks myself too, where I said, I got to take the Facebook icon, the Instagram icon, even the Amazon icon off of the homepage, like my main page, when I unlock my phone, because it just became like this thing that I would click on when I was waiting or bored. Like, I gotta occupy myself with something, which, I mean, is fine. I've always been a person, even when I was a kid, I was one of those kids who always had headphones on. I had a CD player, Discman, way back in the day when we used to listen to CDs.
Oh, yeah.
And I would always have a magazine or a book in my backpack to read something. So I've always had those, I guess people would call them social pacifiers to overcome boredom. But now that you've got these devices that are better than any of the computers that we had when we were in high school, I mean, we're a couple years apart, but we both remember what life was like when you had to sit at the computer and listen to a dial-up. It was like you had to plan to go on the computer.
To be honest, I almost passed all that stuff too, because I was finished high school in like 93, and the internet was kind of just, at that point, it was like, you know, half-naked pictures of Tasha Yar being shared, you know, between people's, like, you know, dial-up connections and things like that, you know. It was really basic, old, you know, primitive internet. And then I never really had a computer until I ended up going to school like 6 or 7 years later. And by then, there was actually pretty decent internet, which was a brand new thing to me. And, you know, anyway, sorry.
No problem.
I do remember those times. I remember that you mentioned a Discman. I remember having a Walkman that had played cassette tapes.
I had that
and
too.
I'd have to buy like a 6-pack of like AA batteries and almost a week's worth of allowance just to get it to play the tape 3 times so I could have it on my paper route.
Yeah.
Which would pay for more batteries. You know?
Pretty much. That's it. I went to work to buy more albums, more CDs. That's it.
That's it.
Simple times. Yeah. It's true. No, it's good to disconnect as much as it's in our faces so much, especially to get our attention. I guess there's like a shelf space in our minds now that everybody is vying for. So it's good sometimes to recognize that and control it to some extent, because it's just gonna, I don't know, there's something aggravating about it and you don't realize it until you say, you know what, just don't look at this anymore. Just disconnect.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the things you've had going on. There's a lot of things that you've been doing. One of them is Dodge. One of them is Sketchlemania. So I want to talk about Sketchlemania first. Big shout out to Martin Slam Duncan. I remember when me, him, and Shane were just throwing around the idea to do something like that, and I'm so happy to see how well it's taken off and how people are enjoying the experience of being on it and asking to be on it. It's better than I think any of us would have thought it would be. And you are the staple. I think you are the anchor of the sketch battles. I was thinking in my head, if we were to make an analog for Mike Ruth, the artist, to what he would be for a wrestler entering the Battle Royal or showing up at a WrestleMania, I was trying to think who would be that guy. Because you've gone up against some real heavyweights in these sketch battles. Like, you've had Ken Lashley on, Yannick Paquette was on, and you've held your own against all of these gentlemen who are, you know, they're big names in the industry, if you will. So I was thinking to myself, who would Mike be if he was entering the Battle Royal every single time? And you go the distance. Who would you compare yourself to if you had to make that comparison?
Well, I don't feel like I ever win, so that would have to factor into my decision. I think, you know what, when I think back to the original Royal Rumbles, the first few Royal Rumbles that come to mind, I remember there was a couple of guys that went unbelievably long distance in those matches, to the point where it was the first time people were actually taking notice of how long guys were lasting. It wasn't really a discussed thing too much because they were usually over, you know, kind of quickish,
right?
But I remember like Greg the Hammer Valentine being mm-hmm. a guy who was like in everyone, or every first few anyway, and he would be in there forever. And he would just take everyone's finishing hold, and he would just take every kind of chop, big boot, clothesline, suplex, whatever he did. And he would be in there 48 minutes later, and people would be like, Greg Valentine is still in this ring. He came in number three or something, and Jesse Ventura, whoever's calling, would be like, holy, yeah, Greg Valentine's been in here a loser for a long time. Or, you know, guys like Rick Martel would go in there, and they'd last almost the entire, mm-hmm. entire thing. It's because those guys were just built like machines, or from that different era, that Bern Gagne kind of era, you know, that Mid-South wrestling kind of era, that where everyone was just super tough. And, you know, it was funny, I was just listening to a speech that Joe Laurinaitis was given the other day, and it was one of these things where he was talking about, at one point, him and Hawk and like Mr. Perfect and Scott Norton, and I think it was like Barry Darso, who was Smash of Demolition,
and Repo Man, right?
And Nikita Koloff, and like just Ravishing Rick Rude, and all these dudes all worked together as bouncers at the same bar.
That's right. That's right.
It's just so fucking cool.
The Minnesota guys, right? They're all from Minnesota.
Become like household names in the sport of pro wrestling, and they're still talked about today. They're legends. They're all sadly, mostly gone. Really, there's only a few left, and my God, Animal was young, man. He's only 60. Sorry, I didn't mean to get all into a different topic there.
But, no.
Slide into like the grim wrestling news of the week, but yeah, it was. Anyway, sorry.
No, that's okay. I was gonna, dude.
It's always hard to lose a wrestler. It's always hard to lose an iconic hero. It's like when a character, you know, is killed off in a comic book or something like that, and you think it might be permanent. This is the real deal when you lose these guys, and it's for all accounts, Joe was a pretty clean living guy, you know. From what everyone knows of him, and it's just 60's way too young for Road Warrior Animal, but
totally. Yeah. I was. All those guys you mentioned, they were the Minnesota boys, right? They all came from that same class, same training, and man, were they good at their craft. There was something about those guys from there. And I think they were also the ones, if I'm getting my facts straight, they all had that Loins of London insurance thing, all those guys from Minnesota, that if they got hurt, their bodies were actually protected. Or they would, like, I remember when Mr. Perfect hurt his back in WWE, it was he had some sort of insurance thing that made it worth his while to not wrestle right away. I'm not sure if I'm getting my facts straight, but that was something they had in common.
Right. And Animal, I believe, did the same thing.
Yeah.
Animal had a pretty savage, I think it was a back injury as well.
Yeah.
And it was one that kept him, or a shoulder or something. I know he had a couple of big rotator cuff tears, I think, in his career. He was always doing the press slam. That's just bound to happen. But I think it was a back issue. That's what it was. Sorry. He ruptured a couple of discs. That's what it was. He landed a bad suplex or a bad slam or something, and he was saying the same thing, that when the option came to take some time off, it actually made sense. When he actually came back, he was legally only allowed to come back in tag team wrestling according to his insurance. And even at that point, he was ready to kind of do his own thing, but couldn't do it. That was it.
Yeah.
So it's a shame. He was smart. He was one of those guys who was smart. Like, him and Road Warrior Hawk made so much money. They made Hulk Hogan level money, and they were probably, other than Rick, they did better than Ric Flair. They did better than a lot of those guys, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were just such good businessmen. An Animal was the brains of the operation, I think, for the most part, from what I gather. But I mean, of the two, I think I'm more of a Hawk guy than an Animal guy in terms of their careers. Hawk had a pretty cool singles career for a while in Japan, and he also teamed up with Kensuke Sasaki as the Hellraisers, kind of like a different version of the Road Warriors in Japan with Kensuke, the Power Warrior, and that was amazing stuff too. But yeah, Animal was smart. Animal was always a smart businessman. They had the Zubaz thing. They had the Zubaz pants. They owned that company, I believe. There was all kinds of stuff that the Road Warriors had their hands and their sponsorship in. They were just really, really smart dudes.
Yeah.
And, their style was one that was like, when you think about how well known they were from the start, that they were appearing in video games and merchandise. I mean, the merchandise on them alone is insane, but even the merchandise off the bootleg stuff of theirs is insane, because the Road Warriors were such a worldwide sensation. You want to watch something cool, if anyone, wrestling fans listen to this, you want to watch something really neat, watch some of the Hulk Hogan versus Road Warriors stuff from Japan, because, in Japan, the Road Warriors were so huge, they were so over, that it was almost the fans didn't have a choice but to boo Hogan, because they couldn't boo the Warriors. And they had, there's Hawk with a press slamming Hulk Hogan, in the match, just insane. Gotta watch that stuff. It's so good. They were so huge and all around the world.
Yeah, who didn't like, that's the thing. Who didn't like the Road Warriors or the Legion of Doom, whichever one you knew them as? Like, when they came out, you immediately were, one, scared of them, and one, impressed by them. And they were like, it didn't matter if they were heels, you were going to cheer for them. I don't think there had been a team quite like that who transcended that sort. They were the tough bullies who you knew were stronger and should beat everybody. And even if they cheated or press slam Hulk Hogan, like you said, you'd be okay with that. Like, it was them. They could do that.
Absolutely. They just they transcended good and evil. The problem with the Road Warriors was they really were designed to be bad guys, to make the smaller guys of the Rock and Roll Express and the Midnight Express and the Fantastics and all those small Mid-South and Memphis area kind of like tag teams, to make them look great by getting murdered by big monsters, but then having the big redemption storyline. But the problem was, even as heels, people had no choice but to, even when they were brutal, even when they tried to gouge Dusty Rhodes' eyeball out with one of the shoulder spikes back in like the late 80s in NWA, WCW, like they attacked their friend Dusty Rhodes, gave him the Doomsday device, and then tried to gouge his eye out with the shoulder spikes, and people still cheered. Like, it was just bananas, man. So they just had that kind of immense power, they just transcended that. And there's no other team that'll do that. There's no other team that'll achieve that. And that's just a fact. I'm not saying that as a shot against any of the current tag teams that exist, because there's some fantastic tag teams that exist. But no one, not even the teams that were their peers at the time, could achieve what the Road Warriors did. Oh, some would argue that the, you know, the Hearts were greater, the Bulldogs were greater, the Demolition were greater, you know, whatever your favorite flavor of team was, but the facts are the facts. And across every country, across every place where there's wrestling, the Road Warriors won the belts there. You know, it doesn't matter how many times the Dudleys have won, 15, 20 times they won the WWE titles, the ECW, it doesn't matter. They didn't win it in the AWA, the NWA, down in Mexico, across the sea, in 14 places in Japan. Like, you know what I mean? They just had a massive reach.
Yeah.
They were huge. They were huge.
They gave the tag team titles, again, back in that era of wrestling that we grew up on, the titles meant something based on who held them, and they were like the perpetual tag team champs. Whether they had it around their waist or not, you knew they were going to get it at some point.
Well, they were going to get it, and they were probably going to lose it in a controversial way, because the problem that I think a lot of bookers had, this Ric Flair, I think, talked about this in his book, the problem with Road Warriors having them on your roster is that if you put the belts on them, no one can believe they can be defeated. And then you have to really kind of bend people's faith a little bit to actually get those belts to lose. So to get those belts off them, like, you know, it's like when they put the belt on Brock Lesnar. Like, by rights, no one should be able to beat Brock Lesnar. No one should be able to, inside or outside of the ring, be able to beat him. Well, we know wrestling is storytelling. Wrestling is good versus evil. There's no reason why they couldn't have had Lesnar, after he beat The Undertaker, go on undefeated for something like 3 years, and then finally have a Daniel Bryan or a guy like that take him down. Like, tell a real story. Like, tell, but otherwise, just have him as the unstoppable champ, like we had when we were kids. Only we grow up, we have different times now. We can't have a 3 or 4 year Hulk Hogan title run anymore, because you know no one would buy that. But I would buy a Brock Lesnar one. I think everyone out there would. And I think that's the, you know, I think because wrestling's changed and the sport has changed, and we're consuming more violent sports, and we don't have the same kind of simple plot lines and storylines. Everything has to involve extreme violence and people's families and, you know, absurd, you know, religious attacks and whatever it is, right? It's not just giving someone the DDT, you know, or hitting them with the guitar on the Piper's Pit Show or whatever it was, you know what I mean? There's nothing like that anymore, but,
yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
No. I plan to talk wrestling with you when you come on the show, so it's not a problem.
To me, the Road Warriors are guys like Vader. They're guys like, you know, they're guys who had that gigantic, like Bruiser Brody, you know, these gigantic worldwide reaches. Just, you can't touch them. When you show up in a video game, when you show up in bootleg video games, when you have characters that are made up to look like you in other video games because they can't afford to get you in their video game, and that's happened a million times with the Road Warriors. If you go back through wrestling video game history, Road Warrior Hawk shows up a whole bunch of times in video games under a different name, because they couldn't afford the Road Warriors license, because the Road Warriors are smart businessmen, you know. It's just, and or, you know, or as the case may be, rights were owned by Vince or by whatever the, you know, whatever the situation was with regards to that. But Road Warriors were huge, and they were an event, and you can't always put, that's why Andre the Giant was never the champ. When you have a team that's an event, the Road Warriors came in and murder a team in 30 seconds. Doomsday Device before the second, you know, before the bells hardly run. They've already got him up on animal shoulders. It was a jobber weekend kind of show, but that didn't matter. I'd stay up and watch a 3-hour boring ass show with Tommy Rich doing a headlock for 45 minutes just to watch 30 seconds of the Road Warriors murdering a couple of jobbers. You know what I mean? I would eat that. I would eat, and that's nothing against Tommy Rich, because he's fantastic. But as a younger fan, I wanted to see Sting. I wanted to see the Road Warriors. I wanted to see Dr. Death Steve Williams body slam someone bigger than him. You know, there was a lot of old school wrestling in WCW in those days too. And sometimes it would just be like a, what I'd call like a long headlock. You know?
Yeah. No, it's true. You go back and watch even some of those matches that you were enthralled with. You're like, man, Hogan's been in this headlock for a while. But you were just waiting for the comeback, right? No, it's true. Do you think that the Road Warriors, I again don't know my wrestling history as well as you do, but it seemed like anybody who painted their face back in our era of watching wrestling, it was a big it was a big deal. There was some sort of getting over with that. Were they the first ones to really be known for painting the face? Because of course you think of Ultimate Warrior, you think of Sting, you think of Demolition, but were the Road, was there anyone before Road Warriors who were known for that?
There probably were to a certain degree. Like, I know a lot of times they would have white, you know, Anglo-Saxon, you know, people playing, you know, sometimes Asian caricatures or fake Mongolian type characters or this type of thing. So very often face paint was employed for that. There was also the Missing Link, who had a solid green face paint. The Great Kabuki, though, I don't know if he predates the Road Warriors. He might, but the Great Kabuki came out years before the Great Muta, and he had a full face paint in that kind of Japanese sort of traditional style. The Road Warriors, though, yeah, they were the first ones to kind of do the face paint in that regard, but they really just admittedly ripped it off from the Road Warrior films, where you have that one sort of character with the red mohawk. He's just got very simple stripes under his eyes or a couple of marks in his forehead. And then when they first started out, their paint was very simple. But then they just had this kind of, I remember watching them, because my first exposure to seeing the Road Warriors on TV was like probably 1988, and the reason for that was we just didn't have any TBS in Canada at the time. When TBS finally started airing wrestling, it was pretty much in the late 80s, and they had a TV show called Learning the Ropes, which was starring Lyle Alzado, who I believe was a CFL or an NFL star at the time. We did a lot of like commercials and stuff in the 80s, but he had this TV show where he played this like substitute school teacher who at night was freelance as a pro wrestler. And Dr. Death Steve Williams actually did all of his stunt work in the ring, in the wrestling vignettes in the show. But I would watch that show, even though it was a dreadful half-hour sitcom where he's like a single dad trying to be a wrestler and a school teacher. So there's all like, it's all lesson-y and morally and stuff. But in the show, there would always be crossovers or a couple interactions with these NWA wrestlers. Because up until that point, I had only read about the Road Warriors and Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes and Barry Windham and guys like that through black and white magazines, like, you know, Wrestling Insider, all the like pro
Wrestling Illustrated. Those books
were my Bibles when I was young, because we didn't get it on TV. And then, so by the time the Road Warriors showed up in WWF as the Legion of Doom in the red plates, I was already anticipating them coming, because I had had about 2 years prior to them showing up of actual tiny snippets of them on this show. But then also, if I found out, if you stay up until 3:05 a.m., I could watch like a 55-minute show, which was like 45 minutes of wrestling and about 10 minutes of Lance Russell or like Jim Ross talking, which was fantastic. Jim Ross was just young then too, and it was, I consumed every minute of it. I couldn't get enough of it because it was such a different thing than what Vince was doing, and it was all about the wrestling. There were storylines and there was plot lines for sure, but there was no, it didn't have the budget for that massive pageantry that Vince would put on, and it really focused on the sport itself and the technicians in the ring. And the Road Warriors, I saw them show up, I heard Black Sabbath music come on, and I saw them come down and destroy these two jobbers in 30 seconds and then leave. And my jaw was on the floor. And that was about 1987. I saw a very young Sting with a mullet beat a guy with a scorpion deathlock. I saw a super young Rick Steiner with big head of curly hair, you know, and it's just amazing to think back on those days, what an alternative it was. And it was so neat to have that. So yeah, when they showed up in Vince's thing, I knew everyone was going to flip out because I'd already been flipping out for 2 years.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And I think everybody at that time wanted to see them against Demolition, because there was always that accusation that Demolition was, you know, trying to capture whatever the Road Warriors had established. I don't know if how they were similar enough to see it and different enough to say maybe not, but definitely it was the match you wanted to see, because they were each faction's top tag team that seemed unbeatable, right?
Yeah.
So
it's you know what, for me that was the biggest ripoff out of the whole thing as a fan, because obviously the Demolition was a copy. I knew when they showed up there, a copy of the Road Warriors. I knew immediately, and you know that's never been disputed. They were a straight copy of the Road Warriors. They before the Road Warriors, before Demolition showed up, about 2 months before Demolition showed up on any kind of programming, the Road Warriors were at Vince McMahon's house, and Vince made them an offer, but it was not an offer that had a money contract. Mm-hmm. It was an opportunity, and the Road Warriors had the highest contracts basically of any wrestler other than Ric Flair at the time, and it was real money and a real contract with a real TV station, and it was guaranteed. And so the Road Warriors thanked Ms. Vince for his time, and they went back to work for the NWA and, you know, and Turner Broadcasting, and that was the end of that discussion. And 2 months later, Demolition showed up on TV. So that's never been a dispute, but the way it was sold on television was that the that the Road Warriors, when they showed up, of course, they were sold as the imposters. Oh, the audacity that these Legion of Doom would show up and try to pass themselves off as a second-rate Demolition. They did the same thing with the Powers of Pain, but the Powers of Pain actually were the Powers of Pain exactly as they were in Vince's League only a few months before in the NWA fighting the Road Warriors. And it basically, the Road Warriors had a real contract, and Vince was said, well, if I can't get you, I want these Powers of Pain. And the Powers of Pain are in the first Survivor Series, and they win it. They win the huge tag team, spoiler, it was a long time ago, they win the huge tag team Survivor Series match, which is my favorite match in Survivor Series history. But it's incredible. And they win, and they are the best that Vince could muster at the time to fight Demolition, because he couldn't get the Road Warriors. It was basically once the Road Warriors showed up there, the reason they rushed that feud, the reason the Hearts ended up with the belts, really, was because, and the timing was weird, because they totally could have had the LOD show up and just win the belts. They could have done that Survivor Series match, or the SummerSlam match where the Hearts won the belts for the second time. They could have swapped out the LOD. People wouldn't have cared. They could have just walked in and been the number one contenders right away, wrestled that match and won the belts that day. But instead, they'd shut, oh, well, let's try to do something else. Let's put the belts back on the Hearts. We know the Nasty Boys are coming in. They'll eventually take the belts off the Hearts. In the meantime, or the belts off of whoever, in the meantime, we can have the Road Warriors do this Demolition thing. But once they had the Road Warriors, it was kind of like they had the real McCoy. You know, they didn't really need Demolition anymore. So we actually never got a straight-up Demolition, original Demolition, Axe and Smash versus Animal and Hawk. We never got that. Instead, we got Axe and Smash versus Animal, or Axe and Smash and Crush versus Animal and Hawk, or we got Smash and Crush versus Animal and Hawk. We never got the match. We never got the one we deserved. Mm-hmm. And the reason was, I think at the time, they brought Crush in because I think Bill, who was Axe, who's an old, much older guy than the other two, he had some kind of heart issue that he thought was going to end his career. So they wanted to keep the Demolition alive as a thing. So I always thought that was kind of a ripoff, because of course, you know, the Hearts would drop the belts to the Nasties, and the Nasties would eventually lose them to the LOD. But yeah, it would have been nice if they just had the LOD show up and go through the whole tag teams and kept the belts on the Demos in a way. And I'm saying this as a Hart Foundation fan. I love that SummerSlam match where the Hearts won, because honestly, as a Hart Foundation guy, I went in there thinking they were going to lose. I went in there thinking for sure, with the LOD showing up, there's no way they're going to have the Hearts win the belts and not have this LOD versus Demos match for the belt. There's no way. But they did the exact opposite of what they thought, and the Hearts won the belt. So I'll take it. It was a good day. But it was one of those things, you know. It was one of those things. Again, you mentioned earlier the importance of the tag team belts back then was humongous, man. It was huge. It was huge.
Yeah.
Gigantic. Gigantic, you know.
And a lot of those guys were part of those tag teams went on to be some of the greatest talent ever. Like, you think of even the Rockers with Shawn Michaels, Hart Foundation with Bret. You know, the Arn Anderson with the Brainbusters, they were really good talent within those teams, and those belts meant something at the time. It was fun. I mean, you think of that SummerSlam 1990, you would never see a tag team hold the belts until WrestleMania nowadays. There's too much show now, right?
There's not a long enough attention span for the average fan. I think that's the problem. That's the issue. I remember thinking that Ricky Steamboat 2 month Intercontinental title reign was super short.
It is super short for then.
It seemed so crazy that his title reign ended so quickly, given the situation and how long he sought after it versus Macho Man, like how long that feud was, how crazy that feud was. It seemed like such a weird thing that happened. And then for, of all people, Honky Tonk Man to have it the longest. It's kind of what makes that belt so important. That Honky Tonk stamp on that belt actually makes that so important. It made it a defining moment for Undertaker, for Ultimate Warrior, rather, when Warrior beats him in 30 seconds, the following year. Like, it's the belts were hugely important back then, and his reign, Honky Tonk's reign, was only slightly longer than Macho Man's reign, by like maybe 60 days or something like that, or 45 days or something. It was back then the belts meant something for sure. That's why it was such a huge thing when the Hearts won. Speaking of the Hearts, that's one thing I wanted to mention. I know we were starting to talk about the Sketchomanias, we got way off course because we got into the wrestling thing. This weekend, I don't know when this is airing that we're doing right now, but the weekend of this current weekend of September, like 25th to 27th, is the Africa Comic-Con Africa, and during that, I actually got to have a 45-minute Zoom chat with Bret the Hitman Hart.
That was the next question I was going to ask you. So, yeah. Tell me everything.
Oh man, it was I think you'll have access, or fans will have access, to be able to actually watch it if they want. I think the whole thing is about an hour and 15 minutes. I come in about a half hour into it, I think, and then I really my friend Patrick, who hosted it, he really just kind of sit back and just let Brett and I chat, and I probably sound like a totally gushing fanboy in the thing, because I am. I mean, it was like, you know, I've got this shot of one of Frank Frazetta, the Frost Giant's daughter, painting on my wall, a poster on my wall, and right away Brett was like, "Is that a Frazetta?" And we started talking about Frank Frazetta. You know, I'm talking about Frank Frazetta with Bret Hart, and I'm sitting here going, "What the hell, man? Is my life even real right now? Like, what's going on?" Like, it was just really mind blowing, man. And he was just so kind and generous with his time, and he was patient, because I'm sure I probably rattled on a while with all kinds of fan love, but you know, I talked to him about the artwork that he produced in the ring, you know, what he did with his art, like what his craft, and we also talked about the fact that he's also a great cartoonist, and mm-hmm. You know, we talked about some of his cool cartoons and around his cartoons, and he shares a great story about a cartoon he does for Andre the Giant, a personal cartoon that everyone signed, and a very special moment in his career. And I got to talk about my hero Jim Neidhart with him, and it was a subject that I was sort of afraid to mention, because it has been a couple of years now since Jim passed away, but I see Brett occasionally post about Jim, and in memoriam, and I don't know what it's like to lose a brother, but I can't imagine the horror of it, and I know he's probably feeling that loss, a lot more than his fans are, than even his fans are, and so I was able to talk and tell stories about Jim Neidhart, just talk about how when I was a kid I wanted to be Jim Neidhart, and how the Hart Foundation was just something that me and my friends aspired to be and wanted to be, you know, how me and my brothers were the only kids on the street cheering when the Harts cheated and beat the Bulldogs for the tag belts, you know, like I lived in a street full of British expats, and like, you know, we were just dancing around as the Harts won, you know, because I had already been exposed to Stampede Wrestling at that point, you know, I knew who Brett was already, man, and you know, it's just cool. I got to nerd out and talk with Brett about a specific match he had in Boston before the Harts were even like a huge tag team, and he wrestled Ricky Steamboat. You can watch it on YouTube. Just look up Ricky Steamboat versus Bret Hart.
I think I watched that match after your recommendation.
It's an incredible match, and I got to nerd out about that for a while with him, and he appreciated that. He was actually talking about some other points in the match, which I had noticed, but then they were actually the more important parts of him, and that was that kind of emotional connection he had with the fans. You know, here's Brett, this heel in this match, and he's just in front of everyone in Boston Gardens. He's defeated Ricky Steamboat while the referee was unconscious. He knocked him and beat him clean with the heart attack lariat. Has him pinned clean in the ring, and everyone saw it, and the referee wasn't there to count it. And then, of course, Ricky ends up winning by some kind of roll-up and pins Brett. And immediately after he's pinned, Brett just looks right at the camera, and he's so pissed, you know. He's just, you can see the rage in his face because he knows he beat the top babyface in the world of wrestling next to Hulk Hogan. He knows he just beat him in front of all these people. And it was just this cool thing for me as a young fan to see, you know, to see Bret Hart as a heel clearly defeat the good guy, and you know, to make me stop and almost it legitimizes it, you know. It legitimizes the sport a little bit for a guy like me who's getting teased for watching a silly sport that wasn't real, you know, a fake sport or whatever you want to call it. It was firepower to battle that, you know, that kind of ideology that it's all fake. I always laugh. I always think that is such a ridiculous thing when people try to make that, oh, you know, it's fake, right? You're really into this, Mike. You know, it's fake, right? Well, you're really into Star Wars, man. You know, that's fake, right? You're really into, you know what I mean? You're really into fucking Young and the Restless, man. That's pretty fake. You know what I'm saying? So it's just that kind of thing, right? Like, I get pissed off at that. And Brett was one of those guys that made it feel real. And I wanted him to know that that's what he gave us. And that's, I wanted him to know how important it was that he gave that to us as fans who wanted to make it real. Who for us, it was real.
Yeah, no, you know? you're absolutely right, because I got teased for the same thing, and you look at some of those matches and you could see Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan. There was all pageantry, like you said before. But with Brett, especially when I remember SummerSlam 92, and I totally bought the Family Feud. I totally bought it. And then at the end of that match, when he gets pinned and he looks like, damn, he got me. I as a kid, I was actually heartbroken, because that was that moment where he became my favorite wrestler for that event. I really wanted him to hold the belt, because, you know, when you're 7 years, I think it was 92, I would have been 8 years old at the time. And it was all about the guys who with the big muscles, the Ultimate Warriors and the Macho Man and the Hulk Hogan. Those were the champs. Yep. But at that event, I just fell in love with Bret Hart, the singles wrestler, the Intercontinental Champion. I just felt he is actually the best. I believe he's the actual best wrestler. And he made me believe that the sport was real. No problem.
Hang on just a second. Sorry.
No problem.
I'm wondering if I should maybe switch off your video, because I think what's happening is
feedback.
Yeah, maybe just go to audio. Oh, now I can't hear you though.
Okay.
Oh, now I can hear you. Okay.
You got me? Let me take the video off.
I'm wondering if it's just causing. I've got kind of a terrible connection here, so.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, that's already sounding a little smoother. Maybe that's all it is, man. Yeah, sorry. It's just this junky building. It's got junky ass Wi-Fi.
No problem. No problem. Yeah, no. That I always remember that event, and just the way that he reacted. He would make guys like what was that Japanese wrestler who had all of the tattoos on his body?
Oh, Jinsei Shinazaki, but he was called Hakushi.
Hakushi, WWE, that's
WWF.
It.
Yeah,
he almost put that guy over, and you wouldn't think that a former WWE champion or WWF champion would even have a problem with this guy, but he made all of those guys look formidable, kind of like a Ric Flair did, even though you knew that they would eventually win. I remember one great match he had with 1-2-3 Kid, where it looked like he would... Oh. Amazing match.
I know which one you mean. Yeah, where Kid goes to finish him with the flying drop kick, and Brett just steps back and grabs the legs.
That's
and
the one.
Him.
That's
it's
the
just
one.
The most beautiful finish. And you know what? He made the Kid a star that night.
Yeah.
He made the Kid the star the same way the Undertaker made Jeff Hardy the star that night on SmackDown.
Right.
Or whatever. all those years ago. It was the same thing. It was a, you know, Jeff was already, a star, but it was the same kind of idea, right? Yeah, totally. I totally get what you're saying, man.
Yeah, I'm a total Bret Hart mark. Anybody who knows me, there's, if I were to give a top five things that I love, he would be in it, and he was the one person that I paid to meet at a Comic-Con. I don't usually pay to meet a celebrity. And it was the year that you drew the commission for me in my book of the Bret Hart commission.
Oh, wicked, man. Yeah, you know what? It's funny that you say that. There was a show, I can't remember which one it was, that he and I were supposed to be at. And I'll send you the picture in a few minutes, actually, when they're done. Just remind me if you don't get it. I was doing a poster. I was supposed to do a poster for this show, a lithograph for the VIP ticket holders. And the idea was to do like a, you know, kind of a limited edition thing for the show where it was going to be a Bret Hart artwork. And there was also some, I think there was some Walking Dead people at the show too. And so the idea was to kind of come up with something that was kind of, you know, maybe a crossover of wrestling and Walking Dead. So I wanted to draw Bret putting the sharpshooter on Sean. But Sean is a zombie. And, you know, guts hanging out and eyeball hanging out and just kneecap exploding and coming apart, you know? And, so yeah, that was fun.
That's the picture I actually got him to sign for me, was the one of him giving Sean the sharpshooter. Even though he lost the match at WrestleMania 12, I'm like, I like that sight right there.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Yeah, I know it's I know which one you mean. That's a great shot. It's I wanted to basically do something like that, but I wanted to have Sean kind of more like more desperate and howling, like Bret's just sitting on this zombie version of you know, of HBK, you know, with a sharpshooter locked on and just, you know, torturing him, you know, like just to give Bret a little, I hope that would give him a smile. So I actually never finished the artwork because of the show. I ended up having to cancel my appearance and never got to meet Bret, which was the plan. And the plan was always to give him the original art. So during the course of our conversation, I actually pulled out the sketch, which I had started inking because I already had it fully realized and fully sketched out before I had to cancel the show. And this is going back 3 or 4 years now. So I dug it out of my archives and I inked it up. And I showed him halfway inked, and he actually seemed like he was like he really liked it, like it seemed to make him smile. So I was able to actually figure out how to get it into his hands, and I actually mailed it to him. So
that's great.
So being able to send some fan art to him directly, because I told him, I said, listen, it's yours. I'm just doing this for fun because I've been excited about this interview, you know, and it was just cool, man. It was just super cool. He was the coolest. He was, you know, you know, it's not always nice to meet your heroes, but I can say, you know, 100%, this was definitely the coolest experience of meeting a pro wrestler. In many ways, it even tops the experience of hanging out with the Anvil, because that was just so surreal. Mm-hmm. And there was also, like, you know, beer involved at that one. But being able to hang out in my studio and basically tell a childhood hero, like, what they meant to me, and to thank them, you know, try to thank them for what they did. Yeah, man, it was a thing I never thought would happen in my life, and I'm really, really grateful that it did, and that makes me want to do it again. Like, it was so much fun. It makes me, you know, almost think about just trying to arrange more situations like that where I can connect with these people and maybe do some drawing and, yeah. I don't know, maybe make some merch for these wrestlers. Like, I remember having a conversation with Demolition years ago. We were at a show together, and I got to meet them a little bit, and, you know, we talked about doing some merch, like, you know, some new Demolition shirts that I could design. And just never, you know, one of those things, like, you know, I emailed them and never really heard back, but at the show they were seemed pretty keen on it. So you gotta just kind of, you know, keep on poking sometimes, but that'd be fun. I couldn't imagine anything cooler. You know, I've had some amazing privilege in my life and some amazingly cool opportunities to do some cool projects and work on some cool things, but to be able to combine my art with my love of wrestling would just be, you know, anytime I do it, it's fun. I've you know, other than your commission for Bret, I've been commissioned to draw Bret once or twice before, but then also just recently I've done probably 3 or 4 drawings of Bret for people in South Africa, so it's been for this event, so it's been kind of cool.
Yeah, that's the one guy probably that I would, I don't know what I would give to be able to talk to him on a podcast, or like I met him at the show. I got to ask him a question in the lineup. He was, like you said, so pleasant, so generous to his fans. And then I went to his panel with Martin, and again, super kind to the fans. One thing that stood out to me that I really appreciated was the lineup. All of these celebrities, they get like a time limit, right? And then the line closes off, and then you're out of luck. But there was this one kid, he must have been 10, 11 years old. He never seen Brett wrestle, but he had a championship title belt in his hand, and he was looking at Brett. He goes, "Please, Brett, can you wait for me? Just please." And he looked the kid dead in the eye and said, "I will wait for you." And it was way past the line limit, but he made sure that kid got to meet him, which, I mean, it may not seem like a big deal, but the tone in his voice to really give that kid the attention to be like, "I'm going to wait for you. You don't worry about that. You will not be disappointed." It's one of those things you're like, yeah, the way I imagined him to be, that's what he's showing. And it could be just in front of people or whatever the case may be, but it seemed genuine. So, I mean, to be able to talk to him the way you did, I don't know what I would do. I'd lose it. I'd totally lose it.
Honestly, man, I didn't have any way to prepare because I very much felt the same way. Like, I actually had thought maybe I should write down a few questions. And, you know, I kind of wish I had, because there was two questions I wanted to ask him that I never got to ask him. But
What were they? What were the questions?
Well, so I'm a big wrestling guy, as you know, and I was watching all the wrestling I could get, whatever flavor it came in at the time, whatever federation it was, whether it was local, you know, Hamilton TV Access wrestling for 40 minutes on Saturday afternoons on CHCO or whatever it was, or whatever it was, I would get all the wrestling I could. But back in those days, I would watch Stampede as well, and there was lots of guys from Stampede that would eventually show up in WWF, including guys like, you know, Bad News Brown, and who's Bad News Allen back then, and Makan Singh, who became, you know, Bastion Booger, and you know, Owen Hart, of course, who was the champ at 18 there. And but over all the years and all the different guys that Brett wrestled, I always wanted to know if he ever crossed paths with Barry Windham, because at the time in the 90s, when Brett was at his kind of like peak, Barry Windham was the number one guy chasing the belt in WCW and NWA. Got it only for a moment, basically, and then had a knee surgery that had to happen and ended his great singles rise as a wrestler. But I loved Barry Windham, and that was my dream match back in those days. Was I would actually, because even when Barry showed up as the Widowmaker for a time in WWE in 1988, he showed up with this Widowmaker character, with his eyes set on Hulk Hogan, but this is before The Undertaker, this is before all these kind of gimmicks, right? So he showed up, and the Widowmaker, and Bret Hart was kind of doing some single stuff, and it never happened, and I always thought that would have been such a great match. You know, second generation wrestlers, you know, in the 80s at the peak of their career, facing up each other. And I just actually wanted to ask Brett if he'd actually had ever wrestled Barry Windham. And further to that, when you mentioned Hakushi earlier, one of Hakushi's great rivals in Japan was the Great Muta. And I always wondered if Brett ever crossed paths with the Great Muta. I suspect he might have in WCW during the later years when Muta showed up there with the NWO and Brett was there. I don't know if it happened. I don't think it did. I feel like that would have been a really big fucking deal if Bret Hart wrestled the Great Muta, but I don't know if it ever happened, because WWE did do things in Japan, and that's where you had Hogan and the Great Muta team up against the Legion of Doom, and you had I think Hulk Hogan also wrestled Stan Hansen on the same card or later in that tour, and Macho Man wrestled a lot of the local champs like Junichiro Tenryu and guys like that, and he also tagged up with them. But very often, guys like Bret Hart, when they were over in Japan, would just wrestle other WWE guys or WWF guys. Mm-hmm. And some of those Japan super shows and some of those, you know, those amazing pay-per-views which you can watch on YouTube are really worth watching. You see some really interesting stuff. Like, there's a match in Japan where I just got sidetracked for a sec here. There's a match in Japan where Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich wrestles Ted DiBiase, and DiBiase beats him with a DDT. And it's just such a weird thing for me when you think about how important finishing moves were back then and how different wrestling was back then. The Japanese product is so different that people weren't going to buy anyone going to sleep with a million-dollar dream or anyone taking the Texas Tornado punch and being knocked out. But DDT, they'll buy. And so Ted had to beat him with a DDT. And, you know, just interesting stuff like that. So I always wondered if Brett spent any more time beyond wrestling Hakushi, wrestling any of the Japanese talent when he was over there. I really wish I could ask him that, because I'm just curious what would have happened. Because, like, he wrestled Macho Man in Japan.
Right.
And, like, beats him with the sharpshooter. And it was really weird, but he beats him. Beats him very similar to how he beat 1-2-3 Kid in that match that we referenced. But same kind of finish, but against the Macho Man in Japan.
Right.
Macho Man challenging for Brett's belt in Japan. Like, how weird and cool.
That's,
you know?
That's, yeah.
So anyway, that's just me nerding out there. But yeah, Barry Windham and Great Muta. That was the two questions I had for Brett.
Yeah. I was wondering, too, when I was in the lineup, what do I ask him? I got one chance. And I have hundreds of questions that I wanted to ask him my whole life. So I asked him, what was the most anticipated sharpshooter that he knew he was going to put on the guy? Which one did he enjoy the most applying?
It's funny, you know. It was so weird when he started using the sharpshooter for me, because I remember his finisher as a singles guy used to be the pile driver, and he did a perfect Paul Orndorff style pile driver. And it was actually the first time I saw the sharpshooter being used as a finishing hold was actually Ted DiBiase. His first couple of weeks on television, WWE as the Million Dollar Man, his finishing hold was whatever he used to beat the guy with, but a few times it was actually the sharpshooter. And eventually Brett just adopted it and started using it all the time. And he really sank. Better to be a death lock than Sting.
Sorry, I lost you there, Mike.
It's a move original. Oh, sorry, man.
No, I lost you in the part where you said that. I think you were about to say he really sank into that move.
Yeah, he really sits into the sharpshooter. I always thought, I probably never would say this to Brett, but I thought Owen Hart actually had a much nicer sharpshooter, because he applied it differently. If you look.
Mm-hmm.
He tucks his arm underneath, in between the knee
and
his opponent's, and it added it, to me. It always looked like it would add so much extra pressure. It probably doesn't, but to me, it looked like a nastier version.
It was a little tighter. It was a little tighter the way he did it.
Yeah, it looked like it was. It looked like it was. But it's so funny for, you know, again watching Owen Hart's entire career, when he started using the sharpshooter as his finisher, I remember thinking that was so weird, because Owen Hart could do anything. I mean, the guy could beat you any way he wanted. That pile driver that he injured Austin, you know, that was a pile driver that he used frequently and did frequently. And it was an ugly pile driver, man. But it was so terrifying. It was almost as terrifying as like the Steiner screwdriver. That same kind of like you really feel like the, you know, the rules, the you know, the tracks have the wheels have gone off the track with that move. As a fan watching it, it's like terrifying to watch. But
the one time that it actually hurt somebody, it was so unfortunate. But those guys were consummate professionals when it came to the safety
in
the ring.
A lot of people compare Brett to Owen, and you really can't. I personally think that. I think it's hard to, you know, it's hard to make a comparison. People said, yeah, well, you know, Owen may have been this and that, but he never, at least Brett never hurt anybody. And that's true. Brett never hurt anybody in his career. And Owen, you know, Owen had that unfortunate thing, which unfortunately tainted his career right to the end. And it did force Austin to change his wrestling style, which, you know, maybe wasn't such a bad thing, because Austin had a great run already at that point. But that aside, I'm going to have some people hate me for saying something like that. But that aside, people forget that Austin injured Masahiro Chono in Japan using the same kind of pile driver that he was injured with, that Owen beat him with, that Owen, you know, injured him with. And, you know, the difference being Owen, you know, Owen felt terrible about what he did. I don't think Austin even went to go visit Masahiro Chono in the hospital. And Chono had to change his style in a much more drastic way than Austin had to after he received the same injury from Austin that Austin received from Owen Hart. That's just a little bit of wrestling history out there for anyone who, you know, wasn't paying attention at the time. Owen took a lot of shit for that injury, and it's a terrible thing that happened. But, you know, Austin hurt people before, too. And, you know, there was no comeuppance for him on that regard. So, anyway, that aside, I love Steve Austin. Don't get me wrong. I think the guy's fantastic. The guy's amazing. I don't need him to show up and give me a stunner or any of his fans to go crazy. But that's a fact, you know. His matches with Masahiro Chono changed Masahiro Chono's career.
I mean, that's the nature of the sport, though, right? That's kind of the nature of the sport, unfortunately.
That's it, man. I mean, injuries are crazy. You know, it's funny. We talked briefly, Brett and I talked briefly about Jim Neidhart's, you know, his dementia and how, you know, he talked about how, you know, it's one of those things where that injury probably, the blows to the head that the Anvil received will probably all receive before he became a wrestler, you know, when he was a defensive tackle, you know, in professional football. Like, it was probably, that's where the damage came in, those head-on-head strikes, because Anvil wasn't known for a guy to, Anvil was a big guy. Anvil didn't take pile drivers, he didn't take head chair shots of the head very often. He wasn't the guy that took those kind of head bumps, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the kind of thing that was likely to be a concussion for him received in the wrestling ring. It was probably more likely received on the football field. But yeah, these guys, you know, the injuries are very real and their career ending. I mean, even you know, even the way Sting's career ended with that turnbuckle powerbomb from Seth Rollins, which, you know, it's a dangerous move no matter how you look at it, but it ended the man's career, and it's a shame. Sting, I think, still had a little bit more of a story to tell.
Yeah.
And that's a tragedy, but, you know, that's the thing, it's a tragedy, man. You look back now at WrestleFest, the video game. I mean, who's still alive in that video game? Who's still there?
Jeez.
Who's still alive? Who's still with us? Jake?
And Hogan.
And Barry, you know, Barry Darso Smash. I think Sergeant Slaughter's still with us.
Yeah,
I believe the Sergeant's still with us. And Ted DiBiase. So maybe that game's not the best example, but you know, Earthquake is gone and Warrior's gone.
Well, the tough one is when you watch, I think it's WrestleMania 7, and you go through that show. And you see that Macho Man and Ultimate Warrior match, all four of them are gone.
Yeah.
Like, there's some matches where it's like, damn. Or even when you watch, getting back to the Bret Hart, and you look at old videos of the Hart Foundation, it's just him.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah, when it's Bret and the whole crew, the whole Calgary crew, and, like, you know, we had Brian Pillman and Bulldog. He's the last one.
Yeah,
it's tough, man. And you know, he's 62. He's just only slightly older than Animal. We just lost Animal at 60. Like, my dad was like, "Oh my God, he's only 60." He's like, "From where I'm standing, that's pretty damn young."
Yeah, it's true.
And you know, it's just, yeah, it's crazy, man. But it's a lifestyle, eh? It's eventually gonna catch up with you. It's eventually gonna take its toll.
Yeah.
I mean, by all you know measures, Joe was pretty healthy, I think, you know, from what everyone says. But
God bless Ric Flair, sure, man. That guy's got some genes that they need to study.
yeah, absolutely.
So we are an hour and 12 in, and I haven't even talked to you about Dodge. So let's talk. I want to ask you some questions about Dodge, because we could do this all day talking wrestling.
Oh, I know. Everyone's like, I'm going, shut up, Ruth. Stop talking about dead wrestlers. But Dodge is Dodge. I'm excited about, man, and I'm coming up with a cover right now. I got two cover ideas that we're working on for our Kickstarter. We're going to have our main cover, and then we're going to have a special kind of alternate cover, which is actually an homage to a famous cover, which has a lot of kind of a familiar feel to Dodge in terms of the content with the whole super soldier or you know, a special commando unit kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm excited about that. I don't want to spoil that just yet, but issue one was a success. The Kickstarter was a success. I finished off all of the fulfillments in July, I think we have two or three people that never got back to us on the survey, but I think everyone's actually received their stuff now. And yeah, man, we're excited. I know I'm a little bit behind the gun. I'm a little bit behind. I wanted to have my covers done already so we could launch our Kickstarter at the end of September, and we may still be able to do that. It all depends how this weekend goes. Yeah, man, I'm excited about issue two. We're probably not going to do a black and white edition for issue two. We're probably just going to keep it just to a color version, because now that we have some momentum, we want to keep it going, and I want to get issue three underway. I've started working on issue three a little bit. We're opening up some opportunities for fans when they support our Kickstarter for number two to actually appear actually on the pages of issue three. I know you and Martin have showed up in I think you guys showed up in Morris, right? In Shane Heron's Morris.
Yes, right.
I always thought that was cool to see, and that, I know that's a popular thing on Kickstarter, so I think we're going to do something like that. Matt has a scene in mind which I think is going to be fun, which will involve different people in a bar type situation, so we'll be able to get some backers' faces actually into the book. I got to put faces on people in the crowd anyway. It might as well be people that support the book. So I'm excited about that. And yeah, man, that's kind of the only thing that's really burning right now in terms of what's coming up next for me. I have a really cool couple of covers coming out. One that I'm really excited about, I don't want to say what it is yet, but it's a pretty big new book coming from Aftershock anyway, and I'll tell you at least who the publisher is, and I got to do a cover for that, so it's right up my alley, so I'm excited about that. But other than that, I think things are kind of slowing down a little bit until Christmas, so maybe I can start to finally get on top of my commissions list and all that kind of stuff as we get Dodge sorted out, because issue two is done. I've finished the artwork. I think it's being colored and lettered right now, so we'll be all set to go and ready to launch for the Kickstarter. Hopefully in October we can do that. I do have kind of an Inktober project in mind, or I'm not going to call it Inktober, whatever everyone's calling it now. I have a different idea in mind for doing another book, because last year I did my found object drawing series videos. People really liked those, and I sold all the artwork, so I've got that in mind right now for October. Something cool. I want to offer up something kind of different and cool this time. But yeah, it's been tricky to kind of find my motivation. I'm still riding the buzz of having that conversation with Brett 2 weeks ago. But of course, you know, getting some bad news about Animal and just some overlapping projects right now, making things a little bit more tense schedule wise. But yeah. Anyway, blah blah blah. Very grateful, very privileged, very happy to have the work. And I'm very excited about the next issue of Dodge, because yeah, it's a cool story. And the second issue of Dodge, the first issue lays down some tracks. I don't, you got your copy, right?
I got my copy, and I wanted to mention how much I enjoyed the artwork in it, because I know that for a while you were fighting yourself a little bit on wanting to make things just right. You wanted this book to hit it out of the park, and I gotta say, man, the transition you went from, you know, being notably a cover artist and a pinup guy, and the illustrations that you're known for is very classical style of art, beyond just it evokes a lot of emotion, the art that you do, but to see the transition into storytelling, you did a really good job, man. I really enjoyed it, and the colorist Caroline Nolasco,
yeah
she did I'm not sure how, I'm sure you enjoyed it too, but I think it's such a wonderful addition to the book and the tone of it, especially with the changing of the scenes and the timeline going from the 69 to 85. Excellent production,
yeah,
quality.
Yeah, she really knows what she's doing, man. She colored a lot of stuff, I think, for Chapter House, actually. And that's what, when she sent me samples, it was some really interesting stuff. And I thought, yeah. And I showed her stuff to Matt, and he was like, yeah, I think she's the one for this project. It's been great. I'll be honest with you. At first, I wasn't sure what to think, because you know, I'm a bit of a control freak when it comes to my own work, and I didn't want to really give her any notes because I figure her job is to color the book, so I don't want to tell her how to do her job. You know, she's got the chops. She showed her in her samples, but she knows what she's doing. So I wasn't sure if she knew how to work with washes. That's always a concern with mine when you have washed inks, because a lot of people work in a more flat, solid black and line style. And when you use washes, that can actually complicate the coloring process quite a bit and add to a lot of muddy difficulty with getting bright colors, especially on flesh tone and brightly colored items on the page. But man, she just nailed it, man. And like it had to grow on me. The first few pages, I found them a little bit like, whoa. But the more I looked at them, and the more I kind of like, I found myself just nodding my head like, yeah, this is, I see what she's doing here. Like, you know, and Matt really wanted to capture that kind of 80s, that 80s kind of vibe of that palette, you know, especially thinking in terms of like the Nam comic book and stuff like that, where they had some really cool, interestingly colored covers. And I think we were kind of pulling on that kind of vibe a little bit. And yeah, Carolyn nailed it, man. You know, and I left her to make her own choices on colors. Like, you know, if someone had to have a certain hair color or something like that, that was one thing. But yeah, she really just killed it. I it's a shame that, like, again, with COVID canceling all the shows, I'm sure there would have been opportunities where I could have finally met her and Matt in person, because that's the hilarious part. I've been working on Dodge for 2 years, and I've never actually physically met anyone on the team in person, yeah, other than my wife Erica, who did all the design.
Right.
In the book, like she laid the book out and did like the design of the masthead and just did the whole layout of the book and everything. Yeah, and designed all the materials for the Kickstarter and everything. So yeah,
yeah, it's a good crew.
Team Ruth over here. I haven't met the other team. But yeah, Carolyn's work is beautiful, and I can't wait to see what she does with issue two, because issue two is where I really found my groove, man. I promise you, the payoff that you wanted in issue one is coming in issue two. Issue one, we had to lay out the scene and get you in the environments, the two environments that you share in Dodge. And issue two, you spend time in those two environments again, but it's basically just a straight action book. Like, it's a straight 29 page monster fight. So I can't wait to finally, I really was able to like let go with both barrels on issue two. And issue three is more of the same. Like, it's just a crazy chase scene, and yeah, I'm excited about it. So I hope you guys are gonna love it.
That's great. Yeah, it's good to hear that you're excited about it and you found your groove. Did you find that issue two came easier to you than issue one did?
Yes and no. There was a lot of stuff going on at the time while I was working on issue two. Issue one was delayed again due to some of the struggles I had with my job as the super. Issue two was an entirely different challenge because my replacement at the time ended up being a very bad element in the building. And because we shared the same hallway and because he had keys to our apartment, we felt a little bit threatened by the situation. And so I found it was affecting my work, and the project ended up having a couple of other pitfalls happen to it that were out of Matt and our control. But that was one of the major things, was during the year 2018 and part of 2019, there was I was living in kind of a dangerous situation, which I wasn't really able to vocalize or talk about at the time, but it was affecting my work. And the second issue of Dodge, I'm very proud of the work inside, and I ought to be, because I spent about a year drawing that book, whereas the first book took like 4 months, which is probably 3 months longer than it should have taken. The second book was just way off the rails, and I take primary blame for that. My inability to deal with the situation that was dealt to me at the time with work, and you know, a general sort of state of poverty. It was a challenging couple of years. It made it challenging to do good work, but the work, I feel like it's some of my best work I've ever done. There's a few splash pages of Dodge tearing into the big evil Koshai you meet in issue one, a fist fight between him it's just pretty rad. I'm excited for you guys to see it. So yeah. Yeah, it was. I found my groove somewhere in issue two. It came easier. The action was every page had some action on it. And also, I was doing prime. Most of the pages of issue two were penciled on my iPad Pro in Procreate, which allowed me to speed up some processes in terms of repetitive images that are used or repetitive panels that are used. I was able to copy and paste elements and at the penciling level build up a faster assembly of pages and stuff that's ready to ink. But then the inking ended up being a very slow process because, as I'm learning, when you work digitally, you have the wonderful privilege of being able to, an advantage of being able to zoom in and get really great detail in your pencils, but you still have to ink that thing. And when you ink it, you're going to lose a lot of that detail. And in fact, your pencils, if I'm printing it out on blue line on Bristol board to ink it, because I always like to ink my final work. I don't like to digital to be my final, you know, even if it's color, that's one thing, but I always like to be there to be physical proof that I've done something. I don't like working entirely digitally. So I always print out my pencils on Bristol and then ink them by hand with traditional tools. And I found that to be a lot more challenging because in issue two, there's a lot of pages that are packed, which is to say they're like 9 or 10 panel pages, and some of those panels have 9 or 10 figures in them, full figures. So there was a lot of delicate, tiny detail work, which takes a lot longer than you think it is when you think you're being so clever penciling it. Inker Mike thinks Penciler Mike is a jackass and a fiend, and Colorist Mike thinks Inker Mike has got to be the worst person on earth. So there's a relationship of the three aspects of what I am as a comic book illustrator that need to find a common path, and we're working on it. But issue two was part of that meeting starting to happen. Issue three will be even more on the page. Although I'm going to be a bit rusty, to be honest. It's been a number of months since I've been able to really dig into Dodge 3 because of other jobs. So getting my sequential chops will probably be a little bit of warm-up required. But yeah, I got a thing I'm doing for Davis Dewsbury for Auric of the Great White North too. I'm doing a page in his The Long Winter book, which is coming soon, I think. I know Shane is also doing some pages in that, and I've already done the cover for it. So, yeah, so that'll be a nice kind of get back into the sequential art thing. Because, yeah, it's a different mindset for sure. It's a different brain set. But I think I'm going to come at it a little bit differently this year. I learned an awful lot during those hard times of 2018 and 2019. I really did find out what I was capable of. So I think I just got to come at this third issue with a different approach and higher energy approach and a more positive approach. I'm in a much better place where I live right now. Same place, but we got a good, super decent guy who's also a comic book guy. We're in a much better, much more comfortable situation. It's just noisy as hell, and we can't wait to move out of here one day. But that's a whole other dragon to slay, you know. But yeah.
But there's got to be something fulfilling when you see the final product of Dodge number one. And seeing that I did this, I created this, it's here, that gives you that impetus, that inspiration to know that you can do it again, and it's a dragon that you've slayed in a way. Because I think there's that first thing of, I have this project, it's happening, but it doesn't exist yet, and this kind of pressure we put on ourselves to make sure that it's exactly the way we want it to be. That when you actually do have that baby in your hands, you know you can do it again. So it seems like with the issue two and with issue three coming, that mindset is that ability to know you can overcome whatever tests come your way. So that's a good thing.
It is, man. And yeah, definitely seeing it physically in my hands. I've been working as an artist for a very, very long time, and I've done lots of books in the past and lots of graphic novels in the past for Scholastic Books and for Rubicon and different companies like that. But to actually do my own comic book that's not really my own because it is Matt's property, but to work on something and to breathe life into characters that, you know, I was able to put my own personal kind of stamp on and see them come to life. Yeah, it's seeing it made real, seeing it in my hands, shipping it out to people, doing sketches or signing them and sending them to people. It's surreal. It's cool. And definitely, I wish it had happened sooner. I wish our first Kickstarter back in 2018 had been as successful as we had hoped, because we'd probably be finished the entire project by now, to be honest with you. But I think both of us were feeling a big financial pinch, and when that project failed, it kind of broke our hearts. the first time around. So it put some delays into the project. But yeah, when it finally came out, it makes you believe that anything is possible.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you have good people helping you. Book never would have happened without my wife. And, you know, the team, like Matt Kratzer, who lettered the book, is just genius. Like, he just did such beautiful work, beautiful sound effects. And then, you know, Carolyn's colors. And Matt's telling a really cool story here, man. I think Matt's really telling an interesting, different kind of story. I feel a little ham-fisted in the first issue, looking back and some of the ways I handled it. But you know, you grow. You grow with every drawing you do, and certainly with every page in a comic book. I got to a point where I could email Matt and be like, Matt, here's the next page. I think it's the best page you've ever done. And I would start saying that more often. I would start saying that with each page I was finishing. And that was really a good momentum to kind of build.
That's important.
I think Matt was feeling that too. And yeah, you know, during these, during all this craziness, who would have thought a Kickstarter would have been successful when we're already getting ready for number two? So,
I think it's a new way of doing business though now, Mike. At first... I think people were a little bit nervous to say, I want to put out a Kickstarter, and everybody who is, you know, sitting at home, maybe working, maybe not working in this time of uncertainty, we want your money for this thing we're funding, or we're trying to get crowdfunded. But I think there is an appetite for people to invest themselves into something creative that people are putting together, that with not being able to go out and do it, or go to a store and buy something, or go to a con and support somebody, this is our way of being able to do that thing that we want to do. So I think business and strategy towards the creative arena, Kickstarter is not, I don't think it's in bad taste the way maybe we were, should we, shouldn't we? I think it's good. Yeah.
No, I agree. It feels less pushy now when you're advertising. Oh, it's funny how the algorithms work. I'm, again, further to our conversation about leaving Facebook and, you know, the thinking around that, it's like, I mean, the Cauldron thing launched during their art show, I think, and it was funded within 8 hours, and I didn't even know they had launched it yet. Last I had heard, a few days before they launched it, they were still waiting for it to be approved, because, like, you know, it sometimes takes like 5 or 6 days for a, it can take up to 2 weeks, I think, for Kickstarter to actually approve it once you're ready to launch.
Right.
Sometimes it happens the next day. Sometimes it happens in an hour. I wasn't sure if they were able to launch it. And then next thing you know, it was already funded. And still to this day, I have not seen one Cauldron ad come up on Facebook. I've had to go find it, which has been really weird. And it made me realize that, like, even despite posting 3 to 4 times on my first Kickstarter for Dodge, no one was even aware I was having it. You might have been, because we chatted about it, or other people who I see in Toronto may have known about it because they chatted with me. But, like, man, I was on every channel with that damn Dodge thing a couple times a day, and, like, it just didn't have a hope in hell at the time. And then, flash forward to the world pandemic, and our project funded in 12 hours and Cauldron funded in 8 hours. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
So, exciting times. It's good. It's very encouraging because, you know, I think as we notice things start to get more locked down and people hopefully start to get a little bit smarter, a little bit more reserved with their ridiculous hangouts and parties and exposure. I think, you know, it is the way forward to just connect with people this way. And I'm okay with it. Like I said, I've gotten pretty good at avoiding people. But if I can still get all the good things about connecting with people from this beyond being in their physical presence, then I'll take it. You know, that's what we got to do.
Well, I hope that we can share a beer together again one day. I hope you're not going to be totally avoiding all of us forever. But
No. I mean, I really wanted to go to that Cauldron show, actually.
Me too.
All done safely and everything was good. Like, I didn't hear any complaints out of it at the raid thing. I'm sure that would have been fun. But, yeah, I just, you know what, I'm just not there yet. I'm not there for patio hangouts and stuff like that. Maybe in a park, maybe in a picnic table. But, you know, definitely outdoors, if anywhere. And, I don't know. I'll be back again one day, man. I mean, I'm hoping all the shows will come back and we'll be able to all get together again. They'll be safe and you know, it'll be great. But yeah, you know, we'll just gotta, you know, be patient. I think those days will come. They'll certainly come here faster the sooner we can all get on the same page about it, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I really appreciate issue one of Dodge because you didn't take any shortcuts. As I don't usually study the art as well as I should as a comic book reader, but because you drew this and I was talking to you, I really took a little bit more attention to the panels and the pacing and the action sequences, and with a more critical eye than usual. And you didn't cheat us in any way on this book, and it looks great.
I kind of look back and I sort of wish I had in a few places, because a good cheat works better than a labor-intensive, fully drawn panel sometimes. But yeah, I appreciate you saying that, man. That means a lot. I definitely learned a little bit about how to approach a page. It's funny, I took Ty Templeton's class about sequential art and then basically ignored everything he said, not for any other reason other than I don't know, man. I wish I had opened up my notebook from his class and had that on my desk the whole time I was drawing Dodge, but I kind of got myself into some dangerous waters where I had no choice but to render a thing that I probably could have left out of the panel. But definitely no shortcuts in issue one, and no shortcuts in issue two. Don't expect any shortcuts to come, because the great thing about a shortcut is if it works, you'll never know, you know. So,
right.
But I do appreciate you saying that, man. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there isn't any. All the pages have a very unique paneling and how you've, you know, put the timing on the page. That was the one thing that I appreciated understanding, is that the comic book page represents time from one end to the other, and how do you use that space and time. And with the splash pages, they're timed just right, where you turn the page and you see it and enjoy it. And then with the action sequences, they're just different enough to not become sort of too much in your face, but not monotonous either. I don't know if that makes sense. It's a job well done, sincerely.
Well, I tried to follow Matt's directions to the letter. Matt's scripts are they're not, I wouldn't call them super tight, but there's an intention behind every frame and an importance behind every decision. So every small detail he gives me, I take the letter. If he says make this, you know, show this left hand holding this gun, or make sure it's this left, you know.
Okay.
I do what it says. Am I still there?
Yeah, not yet. No, you're there. Okay. No.
So his scripts are, so really, I mean, Matt's just as much to blame for those pages being successful, because he gave me some great direction to follow. And, you know, sometimes I'd be like, I never pushed back. So like, if he said, you know, this is a 9-panel page, I mean, part of me is like, yeah, it's 9 panels, but then, you know, if I'm smart, I can make those 9 panels work, and I can load them, and I can weight them, and I can time them. And, a lot of that stuff is just kind of more instinctual. I don't actually think about it. So I appreciate you saying that you really enjoyed the timing, because I'm not always conscious of that. And maybe that's just because it's built into what Matt's asked me to draw. I'm an art robot. I've been an art robot for so long. When I was drawing books for, you know, the reason I don't count my 40 plus graphic novels I did for Rubicon and Scholastic as part of my credentials as a comic book artist, even though they were 100% comic book art, it's because the artwork was directed. It was so directed that it was almost like it wasn't mine anymore. It was just fill in the box with this illustration, this sequential bit of information. So to have something that I could actually breathe with and grow with and influence was a different experience as a sequential artist compared to those years. And I really actually wanted, I actually cared and wanted everything to mean something. I wanted everything to matter. I was attached to the material, probably more attached than I should be, because sometimes it's just work. And I think one of the things that slowed me down with Dodge was the idea that I wanted to have a nice, clean, finished page at the end, because I want to be able to sell that nice, clean, finished page or offer it in the Kickstarter. And that's really not what my intention should have been. My intention is to get the page done the best way. And if that means drawing every panel separately on different paper and spooling them all together to make one big page to make it work the right way, then you know, then that's what needs to be done. At the end of the day, I wanted to have nice clean pages though, and so that probably slowed me down a little bit. So issue three might be a little bit different in how I approach it. I kind of want to paint issue three because so much of it takes place in Siberia. I thought it would be cool to actually just, but then I don't want to, I want to see how Carolyn's going to handle the artwork from issue two and issue three, all the gory fight scenes and stuff. I'm excited, man. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just rambling again.
No, we're all excited. I listen, when the artists and the writers are excited about something, it makes the people who are going to read it and consume it excited. So that's important to have that. That's good.
Well, it's really meant a lot to hear such good feedback about Dodge. Like, I haven't heard any bad feedback at all. There might be. I haven't gone looking for any.
Don't go looking.
Checked online or anything like that. But everyone's been really, really kind, man. I'm really grateful for it all.
You know when you've drawn a good page, and you're probably your biggest critic as well. So for you to feel proud about it, keep riding that wave. I mean, you're always the type of artist who's ready to put the other artist over and make them look good, especially in the sketch battles. But you definitely need to be proud of yourself for sure.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. I don't think I put anybody over in the sketch battle. I just get my ass whooped. I'm like early days Mick Foley out there as Cactus Jack, jobbing out to Sting every weekend on you know,
but
jobbing out to Ranger Ross on WCW Saturday Night, you know.
but the putting someone over is only as good as what the guy in the ring does, right? So. You got to give yourself, if you're going to compare yourself to early Cactus Jack, he still became the champion at one point, right?
Yeah, for sure, man. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for all your time. We did a good little marathon here. I appreciate it. It's never difficult, sure, to talk, yeah, to you. And when Dodge 2 is a success, we should get back on and talk more.
Sure, man. Yeah, like maybe we'll get on even when that's about to launch. I'm hoping to launch it next month, but I'll let you know when it's happening for sure, man. It'd be great to get some people interested again, and I think people are already excited about it. And I'm hoping everyone who backed us the first time will come back. And we have some overprints of issue one that we have available for issue two. So if you're just jumping on for the first time, you'll be able to pick up issue one with issue two together and get on the same page right away. And it's pretty exciting stuff. That was the only heartbreaker about Dodge coming when I finally got the copies physically in hand, was they were sent by US by UPS, and I think they were kicked all the way here. The box showed up in such terrible shape. We lost more than like 70% of the books. They were damaged beyond you know.
So annoying.
I couldn't even give. I'd feel bad even giving the bashed up ones away for free to people. They were so banged up, unfortunately. But we were able to get some more done, and everything's good. And I'm excited, man, and thank you for having me. It was it's always great to catch up with you and chat wrestling, even if it's if it's sad wrestling or long-winded whingy wrestling memories.
It's all good.
Look for my interview with Bret Hart, the Comic-Con Africa. I think it's going to end up on YouTube eventually as well, but Comic-Con Africa is happening this weekend, and actually I think they're going to air it at some point, so check it out.
Fantastic. Thank you, dude. And everybody, make sure you follow Mike Ruth on Instagram while he still has it, on Facebook while he still has it, and definitely check him out on the next Sketchomania. Maybe I'll make an appearance. I'll do a run-in and you know, pass the brass knucks to you, and maybe you'll see me there soon.
I'd love to have you in my corner for sure, man. You're a great addition to the show. So and the next show that I'm appearing on, I think, is October 6th, and I got a pretty interesting lineup of people that I'm going up against, so I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome.
Thank
you, everybody. Thanks. for listening. Thanks, Mike. Make sure you say hello to your lovely wife, and we'll chat soon. Stay healthy and keep working, dude.
You too, brother. Thanks again. Take care, man.